So honored to be before you today to introduce the 14th Assistant Secretary for Health for the United States Department of Health and Human Services, Dr. Howard K. Koh. Dr. Koh graduated from Yale College, where he served as president of the Yale Glee Club and Yale University School of Medicine. He completed his postgraduate residency training at Boston City Hospital and Massachusetts General Hospital, and he has achieved the remarkable distinction as a physician of having earned board certification in 4 separate medical specialties: internal medicine, hematology, medical oncology, and dermatology. He also obtained a Master's of Public Health from Boston University's Schools of Medicine and Public Health, where he went on to serve as professor of dermatology. But in addition to dermatology, professor of dermatology, medicine, and public health, as well as director of cancer prevention and control. From 1997 to 2003, Dr. Koh served as commissioner of public health for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. In that capacity, he oversaw a wide range of health services, 4 hospitals, and a staff of more than 3,000 professionals. As commissioner, Dr. Koh particularly emphasized 2 core goals: prevention and the elimination of health disparities. Under his direction, Massachusetts saw substantial advances in areas including tobacco control, cancer screening, bioterrorism, health issues of the homeless, newborn screening, organ donation, and suicide prevention. Prior to assuming the position of Assistant Secretary for Health, Dr. Koh served at Harvard University at the School of Public Health as the Harvey V. Feinberg Professor of the Practice of Public Health, as Associate Dean for Public Health Practice, and as Director of the Division of Public Health Practice. As this incredible resume attests, Dr. Koh represents that rare individual who is simultaneously accomplished as a clinician, as a physician scientist, and as a public health practitioner and leader. It would be hard to imagine anyone in America better suited to serve in his current role as Assistant Secretary for Health. Dr. Koh has a career-long, passionate commitment to reducing the harms from tobacco dependence in our society. During his tenure as Commissioner of Health in Massachusetts, he led that state's model efforts to reduce youth smoking and to help those currently addicted to quit. On the national scene, he served on the Subcommittee on Cessation of the Interagency Committee on Smoking and Health, and on the United States Clinical Practice Panel that produced the 2008 guideline treating tobacco use and dependence. And as Assistant Secretary for Health, he has made the elimination of tobacco dependence from our society one of his chief priorities. And to those in this room, many of whom have devoted your lives to fighting the scourge of tobacco use in America, what a blessing that finally the nation's leading agency for health has among its most senior leaders an accomplished professional who understands that tobacco use can and must be eliminated from our society. I'd like to take a few moments and talk about the Howard Koh that I know as a friend and colleague. I first met Dr. Koh almost 30 years ago in June of 1981. I was an incoming internal medicine intern at Boston City Hospital. He was the chief medical resident, the young doctor charged with overseeing our ragtag group of about 30 even younger doctors set free for the first time to care for patients. Here is a photo of the Boston City Hospital Medical Service, the physicians in internal medicine at that time. Look at how handsome and happy that young man is. I want to tell you a little bit about Boston City Hospital, a remarkable place, and how Dr. Coe so influenced me and the other young doctors who trained there. Here's a photo of the original set of Boston City Hospital buildings, most of which have sadly been torn down. As a poor Italian kid growing up in Boston, City Hospital, as the institution was known to its residents, was a revered place. It was unusual for those times and these in that it came with an ironclad guarantee. At City Hospital, you'd be welcome, doors open, no questions asked, quality health care delivered by a committed set of physicians, nurses, and other staff, with no adjustment to the level of quality or commitment based upon whether you were rich or poor, educated or not, English or Italian speaking, as my people were. I remember as a young boy growing up in Boston, taking my grandmother to City Hospital on the elevator, what we called the Metro in Boston at the time because so much of it was suspended over the main streets of our city. I was there to translate. My grandmother came to America as a young woman in the early part of the 20th century and she spoke limited English. While a poor, uneducated immigrant, my grandmother was greeted at City Hospital with dignity, something that made an enormous impression upon me as a young boy. And when I returned to City Hospital, 2 decades later, then as a young doctor myself, so proud to be part of my grandmother's dream to someday have a doctor in the family, I learned firsthand how an institution can embody dignity. And for me, it was in large part because of the leadership of Howard Coe as our chief medical resident at Boston City Hospital. While we had more fun that internship year than people working 80 hours per week could imagine, Howard was absolutely instrumental in creating an environment of competence, compassion, and commitment. A place where every patient was welcome and cared for irrespective of their station and provided with what we were convinced was the best diagnostic skills and the most competent treatments, all delivered with a supreme commitment to the dignity of each and every patient that walked through our doors. Howard, for your cool, calm, and collected approach, leading us through some of the most challenging days and nights on the wards of City Hospital, for your brilliance as a teacher to a young group of doctors, for the way you instilled in us an unwavering dedication to improving health one patient at a time, for all of this, I thank you. You taught me and those I trained with how to be a doctor. And now, as a nation, this extraordinary man with experience and passion is positioned to improve the health of all of us. His commitment at HHS to prevention and public health, built on a lifetime of experiences, fills each of his days and nights. And his commitment to ensuring that as a nation, we do not ignore tobacco addiction, but instead put a new emphasis on this leading killer of our residents, we will all benefit. I'm sometimes concerned that the statistics regarding tobacco use have been repeated so often so as to inure us to the real tragedy of tobacco dependence. While enormous progress was made in the second half of the 20th century, more than halving tobacco use rates from about 44% in the 1960s to 20% today, tobacco continues to hold in its grip more than 45 million Americans, with disproportionate representation by the most disadvantaged members of our society, including the poor, the least educated, and those with chronic mental and physical ailments. And each year, tobacco use continues to kill prematurely almost 500,000 of our residents. If Howard Koh taught me anything in the last 30 years, it was to never forget that this statistic is devastatingly real for each of those individuals and their families. That for each of these 500,000 dead, there is a child who has lost a parent. There is a brother who's lost a sibling. There is a friend who has lost a loved one. All needless deaths, all preventable. Dr. Koh, for your commitment to these individuals and their families, for your commitment to ending the tobacco epidemic in the United States, for your willingness to take on the honor and the task of serving as Assistant Secretary for Health, I know I speak for everyone in this room today in saying thank you. I had the honor of attending Dr. Koh's formal swearing-in ceremony as Assistant Secretary for Health at the Hubert Humphrey Building in Washington, D.C. on November 20th, 2009. Howard, in your remarks that day, you said that your heart was overflowing with gratitude. I know I speak for all in this room when I say that our hearts overflow with gratitude for your commitment of service to our country. Please, everyone, join me in welcoming to the podium the Assistant Secretary of Health for the United States of America, Dr. Howard Koh.
Done anything yet. Oh man, Michael, that was just too much. Oh boy. You know, one of the great joys of being on this journey of public health is to meet dedicated, passionate, extraordinary human beings who teach you and humble you and inspire you. And one of them, a person who is at the top of my list, is Dr. Mike Fiore. He deserves another round of applause. Thank you. Mike, that was one of the most beautiful introductions I've ever had, and I'm not sure I could even say anything after that. And to watch Mike's astronomical career and see his global impact has been a source of great pride for me. And now to come here to Denver, to APHA, and see this room packed with the tobacco control leaders of the nation and the world, thank you very much for your attendance. Thank you for your commitment. It's a great honor for me to speak before you, to tell you where we are with tobacco control in the United States and where we can all go together, working collaboratively in this new era, and to thank you for not forgetting about this issue, still the key preventable cause of death in the world. So, Mike, God bless you. This is an amazing morning already. Of course, I want to thank APHA and Dr. Georges Benjamin, who year after year puts on these extraordinary conferences. Let me acknowledge the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Other Drugs section and Bob Vollinger, the past president. But most important, I want to thank all of you, because I know that each of you has so much experience, so much passion, so much dedication. This has not been an easy ride, but believe me, we are now joining hands at an unprecedented time, and we are going to be renewing our commitment to end the tobacco epidemic. So that's why we're here today, and that's why we're moving forward, and I'm so honored to see you. Some might say that we have made so much progress in this country on tobacco control, and that it's time to move on to other areas. And Mike has already hit some of the highlights, the fact that adult smoking rates have been cut in about half since the landmark Surgeon General's report in 1964, the fact that more than half of all adults who have ever smoked have quit. But I know that you are here because you understand fundamentally that this is still the leading cause of preventable death and preventable suffering around the world. There is no other condition that has killed 100 million people in the 20th century. There is no other condition that's projected to kill 1 billion people in the 21st century. And we know what works in tobacco control, but we have to reaffirm and redouble our commitment. And so it's just absolutely unacceptable that when you look at our rates of adult and youth smoking, that those rates have stalled since 2004 with virtually no change, that we have extraordinary inequities that are affecting people of low income, of certain racial and ethnic groups, especially those with mental illness and substance abuse disorders, that we have almost 500,000 people dying preventable deaths, as Dr. Fiore has pointed out, that we have over 8 million people in this country suffering chronic illnesses. And then the sheer simple fact that should bother all of us, and particularly bothers me as someone who really wants to make a difference in cancer from the time I first got my MD, is that the leading cause of cancer death in this country is lung cancer for men and women, and the vast majority of that is preventable. In other words, if we didn't have tobacco dependence and tobacco addiction in our society, lung cancer would be an uncommon condition. But instead, it's the leading cause of cancer death in our society. So we cannot tolerate the intolerable, and we should no longer accept the unacceptable. And we have a really extraordinary moment now in history presented to us through FDA regulation, through the Recovery Act, and through the Affordable Care Act, and then through new strategic planning that the department will be unveiling this week. So I want to spend some time with you now describing the aspects of all these issues with you, and would be very, very happy to engage you in conversation and some dialogue when I am done. I'm going to start personally, as Mike has done, because this is all very personal to us. And as Dr. Fiore has pointed out, in many ways, this journey started for me as a young physician at Boston City Hospital. And it's amazing to see those pictures, Mike, of those buildings that are now just in our minds because a new facility has arisen. But our experience at that city hospital at that time reflects the experience of so many of us in so many medical centers around the country. I came to Boston, a newly minted MD from Yale in the late 1970s, absolutely determined to cure every patient put before me, absolutely determined to make an impact on the health of so many patients who sought help from me and my colleagues. And that passion and that sense of commitment has driven me, and I know all of you, through our careers in medicine and also in public health. I went on to care for patients for over 30 years, and that's a sacred gift. And when people share their stories and their dreams for a healthy life and their dreams for a cure, that leaves a remarkable impression, an indelible impression on you as a provider. But as Mike pointed out, what hit me so strongly right from the first days of my training as an intern at Boston City Hospital was the absolute devastation of tobacco dependence and tobacco addiction. You've all seen this. You all have experienced this with friends and relatives, perhaps yourselves. We have all seen too many times patients gasping for breath because of lung disease caused by tobacco dependence, people suffering from premature heart disease caused by tobacco dependence. For me, what was a source of tremendous anguish was seeing people with tobacco-related cancers driven by tobacco dependence. And after you see patient after patient after patient suffering with this, you ask yourself, why? And can't we do better than this as a society? Obviously, we continue and must continue to give patients the best care and the best chances for cure, but we need a better strategy. And that's called public health. And so those images have driven me personally through this, and along the way I've gotten to meet so many of you along this extraordinary journey. First, as the Commissioner of Public Health in Massachusetts, as Mike pointed out, where we had an absolutely great tobacco control program, which dropped statewide per capita consumption by almost 50% in the first decade, before a lot of funding was stripped out of that program, which absolutely broke our hearts. And then later on, I was able to work at the Harvard School of Public Health, working closely with a colleague, Greg Conley, who is so well known to many of you on many tobacco-related projects, and also working on community-based projects with communities that were outraged and wanted to make a difference in this intolerable situation. And now, I have the incredible opportunity to address this issue as the Assistant Secretary for Health. And by the way, in government, since it's so acronym-driven, I am known in government as the ASH. And given all my years of tobacco control, to be called the ASH, I just find so ironic. So as the ASH, I have the pleasure of coming here to APHA to meet with many of you on so many public health issues, to talk about how we can build a better future together. One initiative that we're unveiling next month is Healthy People 2020. You all know that Healthy People has been the roadmap and compass for health improvement for the last 30 years, and a huge part of Healthy People is improving quantity and quality of life, achieving health equity, and specifically focusing in on reducing tobacco use by adults and adolescents to get smoking prevalence in adults down to 12% over the next decade and beyond, to reduce the initiation of tobacco use among children, adolescents, and young adults, to increase successful cessation attempts, and to reduce the proportion of non-smokers exposed to secondhand smoke. There is a great line in Healthy People that I absolutely love, and it reads, "The health of the individual is almost inseparable from the health of the greater community, and the health of every community determines the health status of a nation." So that means for this audience, the way we end the tobacco epidemic is to help individuals, yes, but also make every contribution we can for all of our communities, and together join our communities to make our nation healthier moving forward. So let's look at some of the opportunities presented before us to make this happen now. First, as Mike pointed out, on June 22, 2009, as you know, President Obama signed the historic legislation granting the U.S. Food and Drug Administration authority to regulate tobacco products to protect the public health. What an incredible day for public health for the world and for the country, and for me personally. My personal story on this was it was my first day of work. I was confirmed by the U.S. Senate the previous Friday, and I was asked to report to work the following Monday, and that was June 22, 2009. And my first task was to go to the White House to join about 200 jubilant public health leaders from around the country there and watch as the president made history. Many of you there were in the Rose Garden at that time, and I will never forget that moment for the rest of my life. And I also, if I can say, felt personally that somehow this was not an accident for me. It was somehow part of my journey that was meant to be. So now I have the great honor of working closely with Commissioner Hamburg, Deputy Commissioner Sharfstein, and Dr. Bopper Deaton, the new head of the Center for Tobacco Products, an outstanding public health leader. And the FDA, as you know, has the authority to regulate the manufacture, distribution, advertising, and promotion of tobacco products. Some of these new responsibilities include setting tobacco product standards, reviewing pre-market applications for new and modified risk tobacco products, requiring new health warnings and establishing and enforcing advertising and promotion restrictions. You'll be hearing much more about FDA efforts in a couple more minutes, but over many, many years and beyond, this ushered in a new chapter for public health for the country and indeed the world. Another great opportunity presented to ourselves with the new administration was the 2009 American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, or ARRA, as we refer to it in our acronym-driven government. And in the Recovery Act, some $650 million was invested with a particular focus on tobacco, physical activity, and obesity at the community level. Funding went to CDC, through other parts of HHS, to states, communities, media, national partners. And of this $650 million, some $225 million was dedicated specifically to tobacco control. So that was a great new infusion of funds at the community level, supporting the social determinants approach. And then, of course, the Affordable Care Act was signed into law on March 23rd. For those of you who came to Denver a day early, I had the great pleasure 2 days ago of giving the opening summary of the many absolutely transformative provisions in the Affordable Care Act. And we can talk about its commitment to advancing coverage, improving quality, building true systems of care in so many ways. But the issue that I think is of great interest to this meeting is, of course, the highlighting of prevention and public health. In particular, with respect to tobacco control, there are a number of specific provisions that will advance tobacco control in the Affordable Care Act. First, the Act requires new plans established after September 23rd to cover tobacco cessation treatment by health insurers, since this receives an A rating from the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. For Medicaid, it removes the exclusion of FDA-approved tobacco cessation medications, including over-the-counter medications. It provides tobacco cessation services for pregnant women enrolled in Medicaid. It encourages Medicaid beneficiaries to use tobacco cessation services by offering incentive grants to states. And then, very, very importantly, it offers a new dedicated prevention and public health fund for public health activities. There is so much demand for prevention funding, but in fiscal year 2010, some $18.5 million was dedicated specifically for media and cessation services around tobacco. So again, another great opportunity for us. Now, in my year and a half as the ASH at Health and Human Services, it's been absolutely great to see so much activity within individual agencies that are focused on tobacco control. With respect to research and surveillance and science, we have NIH, of course, led by Dr. Francis Collins, who's becoming a very close colleague. CDC, led by Dr. Tom Frieden, who's made many contributions to tobacco control. At SAMHSA, led by Administrator Pam Hyde. The Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, led by my very good friend, Dr. Carolyn Clancy. These leaders are helping these agencies on the research, on the surveillance, on the science. The CDC in particular has had a long history of building capacity and infrastructure for states through their National Tobacco Control Program. I've already talked about the new role of the FDA here. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services now has an opportunity to do so much more, and some of the concrete benefits I've already outlined for you come through the Affordable Care Act, and we're going to see even greater commitment with the leadership of Dr. Don Berwick, the new administrator who really wants to make this agency a public health-oriented agency. Dr. Berwick is a true visionary and a colleague and friend, so it's great to have Don's leadership there. The Indian Health Service, of course, is trying to reduce tobacco use among its beneficiaries because of especially high rates there. Dr. Yvette Ribudeau is very committed to these issues. Dr. Mary Wakefield, another wonderful leader in our department, leads our Health Resources and Services Administration, HRSA, And she is committed to more integration of tobacco cessation and counseling services for the 19 million people that are covered by federally qualified health centers. And that number is expected to double, by the way, in the next 5 years because of infusion of funds through the Recovery Act and the Affordable Care Act. There are efforts to work even more closely with our global health office, promote even more strongly the global tobacco surveillance system. And then, of course, we can do so much to improve communications in this area because we cannot talk enough and disseminate enough information and commitment about this critical area. So there's the potential activity because we have individual agencies with great leaders doing so much work already. But I think what we now need to do, in fact, what we have now made the commitment to do, is to bring all those forces together to make sure that we are working as one integrated department, one committed department to end the tobacco industry, to end the tobacco epidemic. I'm sorry, I was looking at Stan too much. So we know what works, and you've all contributed to the knowledge base, the science base. We know that state tobacco control efforts work. They're integrated. We know that smoke-free policies reduce exposure and improve health. We know that cessation services and quit lines are effective. We know that aggressive media campaigns that many of us have led can encourage people to become healthier. We know that raising the price drops consumption and can have special impact on youth and low income and other price sensitive populations. So what we are doing now is to take this opportunity to take all these forces that are aligned, the new regulatory authority of the FDA, the new resources made available by the Recovery Act and the Affordable Care Act, and put it all together and really make these efforts come alive to end the tobacco epidemic, to draw on the experiences of a California, to draw on the experience of a Massachusetts, where I had the great honor of working with many colleagues here on so many of these efforts. By the way, in Massachusetts, there is new attention to special efforts for smokers covered by Medicaid. And you know that because of health reform there were mandated benefits to give counseling and medications to smokers on Medicaid, and that effort and that outreach dropped consumption dramatically in a very short period of time. And we know it works because we have experiences also in New York City with leadership from Mayor Bloomberg and first Dr. Frieden and now Dr. Farley, where, again, a comprehensive approach dropped rates in a very dramatic fashion. And then also recently, we've had two major national reports come forward, the IOM 2000 report, Ending the Tobacco Problem, a blueprint for the nation, and then the President's Cancer Panel report in 2007 and 2008, which stated, quote, "Ridding the nation of tobacco is the single most important action needed to dramatically reduce cancer mortality and morbidity. There is no substitute for this action if we are to eliminate the sickness and death caused by tobacco use. For the health and future strength of our nation, this preventable epidemic of disease must be brought to the most rapid end possible," unquote. What a wonderful conclusion that is. So today, I am very, very pleased to report to you that over the last year or so, we have had at the department a working group representing all these agencies that I have just described under the leadership of so many key, inspired public servants. I'm going to particularly mention Simon McNabb, who is here, Rosie Henson, who could not be here, so many others receiving input from experts from around the nation to support the secretary, who announced that this issue is one of our highest strategic priorities. And as a result, this week, our department will be announcing its first ever comprehensive tobacco control strategic action plan. And so we are thrilled to tell this audience about the upcoming announcement, to say that we have witnessed 5 years of stagnation, and that's intolerable, that we should not be satisfied with the status quo. And under this plan, we will have 4 pillars that we want to promote moving forward. First, to engage and re-engage the public. We need the public to continue to hear the impact of what this devastation is doing to our families and our kids. We need to remind people that U.S. cigarette manufacturers are spending approximately $12.5 billion a year, or more than $34 million every day, to attract new users, retain current users, increase consumption, and generally create favorable attitudes towards smoking and tobacco use. The second pillar is to improve the public's health by supporting efforts at the state and local level. We particularly want to help support quit lines, which we know are effective, have been proven to be effective through randomized trials. We know the times are tough, but we have had some demonstrated improvements in commitment financially, as I've just reviewed for you, through the Recovery Act and Affordable Care Act, and we want to use those added resources to support states and local leaders as much as possible. Third, our department wants to lead by example and work even more closely with you, because federal government covers some of the most vulnerable populations in our society. You will be hearing more about coverage issues from CMS, such as the specific one in the Affordable Care Act about coverage for pregnant women, as I just mentioned. And we've already engaged in conversations throughout government to use the social determinants approach to have cessation services tailored for and targeted to high-risk populations in locations such as public housing, substance abuse facilities, mental health facilities, community health centers, and rural health facilities. And then fourth, we want to advance knowledge, because there's so much new science that will be generated, particularly as the FDA advances its regulatory authority over tobacco, and we must use this information to reduce tobacco-related disparities and tobacco dependence moving forward. I am convinced that with the passion and the leadership of everybody here, with the collaboration and commitment of the department led by the secretary, with the efforts of people throughout this country, that we can achieve the Healthy People objective of reducing the adult smoking rate to 12% by 2020 and beyond. I am looking forward to working with you on reinvigorating national momentum on tobacco prevention and control. And I'm very much grateful to you, because you have not given up. This has not been an easy ride. It's been a long, long ride, but it ain't over. We have a vision, and we have a common vision of a society free of tobacco-related death and disease. Thank you very, very much.
All right, want to invite folks up who'd like to ask questions. We've got a microphone right in the middle of the room. I'm going to ask folks to take advantage of this opportunity, but keep your questions brief, and then we'll be able to have a chance to hear from everyone who wants to ask a question. Ma'am, why don't you start?
I'm sorry, say that again.
How much will appropriations be necessary for this, and how much will Congress have an opportunity to limit the impact?
Well, I think we can start by really integrating and mobilizing what we have, because as I reviewed for you, each agency within HHS has already done so much. But if I can say, as one who has overseen this strategic planning process for over a year to see the extraordinary commitment and the feeling of synergy across the department now as we put forward the first ever comprehensive plan for the department is pretty extraordinary. We're also going to build on the $280 million new dollars that came from the Recovery Act and the Affordable Care Act. We have also more funding opportunities for the new prevention fund that's open to year-to-year discussions by first the administration, but now by Congress. So we've got to work on this together, but I think if we show the American people that we have renewed our commitment to this, the leading cause of preventable death and suffering in the country, that we will really make an impact moving forward. Thank you.
Sir.
Secretary Cohen, Dr. Joel Lubinsky from the American Association of Public Health Physicians. Let me note that neither I nor the organization that I represent received any funds from any pharmaceutical or tobacco-related enterprise. I think we have a serious problem. And the problem is in our approach. By considering tobacco control and smoking control as synonymous, we ignore the fact that there's a wide range of smokeless tobacco products that present a risk of illness and death less than 2% the risk posed by cigarettes. All of the morbidity and mortality statistics that we've been quoting are from smoking, and almost all of that is from cigarettes. According to our policy analysis, the possibility exists as the only policy option likely to save the lives of 4 million of the 8 million current adult American smokers likely to die of a smoking-related illness over the next 20 years is to go public, informing them of the reduction in risk possible by simply advising them that they could cut their risk by 98% or better by switching to a smokeless product. Now, when I made these same remarks at this APHA meeting a year ago, I was asked by Dr. Sharfstein to put my remarks and the background material to it in writing through FDA in the form of citizen petition. In February of this year, I submitted two citizen petitions with over 300 pages of background materials making the case for this. As far as I can tell, there has been no response from FDA or any other federal authority, and not even evidence that anyone has read this material.
Well, first of all, we all know that tobacco in any way, shape, and form is harmful to your health, so I want to stress that the plan addresses issues of smokeless tobacco as well. The focus on cigarettes is, I think, appropriate because of the extraordinary burdens and the impact that we've all reviewed together. Now, exactly, and also I should stress that there was a new MMWR that just came out this past week on rates of smokeless use across the country, and many of you are familiar with that. Many of us are also concerned that there is so-called dual use of cigarette smoking and smokeless use, and that has been discussed before and highlighted on a 60 Minutes program last year, as I recall. And now there are many, many suggestions about how to possibly use smokeless tobacco products, possibly in a harm reduction strategy. I think that's what you're referring to. And I think those issues should be subject to the best scientific investigation and best scientific studies moving forward. So this is a broad conversation, but I think it should be put forward as an option that's studied by science and then driven by science in the best possible way.
Dr. Landau.
Thank you, Harry, for introducing this.
Thank you. Well, first of all, it's good to see you, Harry. And Harry's another great pioneer in this area, so I've learned a lot from you. These are issues that are being discussed on a very informal level so far. There's nothing formal decided and nothing formal to be announced yet. And these are mostly discussions within NIH, as I understand. So I think I'm going to wait with you until something formal is announced by those leaders.
But, you know, half of the tobacco-induced deaths is cardiovascular. And the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute has been kind of missing in action on this issue forever. And the benefits of cessation and the benefits of reducing secondhand smoke improve first and almost immediately in terms of reducing heart disease risk. We've done work, which has now been replicated more times than I can keep track of, showing that smoke-free colleges immediately have heart attacks, which contributes to cost containment and health care. And rather than allowing the program, which is working well at NCI, to be booted out, I would hope that you would work with the NIH to not only protect and build that up, but get the NHLBI to develop a quality engagement around this issue, too. So I would hope you would not just wait till you hear what NIH says. You know, give them the benefit of your education, which was outlined, I have to say, in the best introduction I have ever heard in my whole life, to really deal with this, because I think you could have something which is viewed as a kind of blow-up internal political football at NIH really end up wrecking the long-term research capacity in this area.
Thank you, Stan. First of all, no tobacco meeting is complete without Stan Glantz, right? And back when I was a wee babe, Stan Glantz was teaching me, so Stan, thank you. I value your input, and others have shared that input with me, and I can also say I think the National Cancer Institute has done extremely well in their work on tobacco control over a number of years. I respect those leaders very much. The broader conversation is that there's so many ways to organize government. You all know that government is vast, it's huge. The addictions area in particular is one that needs more attention. So there are conversations going. Nothing formal has been decided, and we value your input. So thank you for voicing that.
And I just want to invite everyone. We want to give everybody a chance. So if you could keep your questions focused, that would be wonderful.
Frank Johnson, and I've been involved in anti-tobacco efforts since I was a freshman at the medical school in 1964 when Luther Terry became our dean.
Wow.
In a short period.
Bless you.
I think we clearly are at a new steady state, and the adults who continue to smoke now are different than in most of those who quit in the past, including myself. The majority of adults who wanted to quit and have been able to quit have already done so. So the 20% or so of adults who continue to smoke now, I think, fall into certain overlapping
Well, thank you for reemphasizing many key points, but I do want to stress that this has got to be a comprehensive approach, and you know, we only have about half of states, for example, that have statewide smoke-free policies right now, so we need to support the other half of the states that I know want to get there. And so doing this broadly in a comprehensive, integrated way, based on all the science that we've generated, I think is really the best way. And you've aptly pointed out to the high risk and the target areas that need special attention.
Rod Liu, Partners for Empowerment Advocacy and Appeal. We're one of the six funded organizations, national networks for CDC that address priority populations. And first of all, thank you, Secretary Koch, for your leadership around tobacco control, and particularly around tobacco disparities. And my question is, could you share a little bit more about the plan for addressing tobacco disparities, particularly communities of color and LGBT communities, where there's particularly disproportionate burden that's born within those communities? Given particularly that funding sources seem to really focus a lot on policy, which we really support, but there isn't as many efforts to engage and involve priority populations within these policy initiatives.
Well, first of all, Rod leads Appeal. You all know that group has had just incredible impact nationwide. So, Rod, thank you for your leadership there. And this new plan is going to directly tackle the issue of health disparities and health inequities. We're going to go to where the need is the highest. I already mentioned areas like substance abuse facilities, working more closely with SAMHSA, with community health centers, working more closely with HRSA. Potentially with public housing, working with other federal partners, reaching out to Medicaid populations that have almost double the smoking rates of the rest of the country, so the Indian Health Service populations led by Dr. Rubido. So this is where we have to go in order to keep making progress and reaching the healthy people goal.
Thank you. Carlos Negas, I'm director for Indiana Tobacco Prevention Association and chair-elect of the Tobacco Control Network of State Tobacco Control Coordinators in the state government. Thank you very much for your briefing today. My question is really on behalf of us working at the state level that are targeted incessantly by the tobacco companies. We've been the guinea pig in Indianapolis for these so-called healthier options that were talked about earlier, smokeless tobacco products. We've been the guinea pigs for their pilot marketing and pilot testing for almost every single product that they come out with. And what we are finding is that this is leading to dual use. This is a new product that intrigues young people. It's new and it's different and they're trying it. And we're tired of being the pilot community for the tobacco companies. So in addition to all of the wonderful work that's being done through the FDA, what can be done to help stop the tobacco industry from using our communities to pilot our next set of deadly products?
Thank you. Well, thank you for your passion. And we know this industry continues to be very active to make investments in terms of promoting its product, some $12.5 billion a year for attracting new users and retaining current users and increasing consumption. So you've just described some of their strategies. But we are in a new era where products have got to be viewed by the FDA moving forward. And so I think as you experience these new products, let others know, make sure the media knows. And I think when you tell a story like that, it just reemphasizes again that this story is far from over. Unfortunately, too many in this country feel like this problem has somehow been solved and it's time to move on to something else in public health. I'm just always astonished when I hear that. And so your story reemphasizes that this is a very active industry with a lot of resources. And so we have a lot of work to do. Thank you. Yes.
Sir, would you mind if there's some folks that have been waiting in line? I want to respect that. And if you can get in line, we'd be happy to hear from you. Ma'am.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for raising that issue, which particularly affects African-American consumers, as you well know. And so you all know that with the establishment of new FDA authority, there's a new scientific council that's been assembled with some absolutely top-notch scientific leaders. And the chairman is Dr. John Samet from California, who has helped write so many Surgeon General's reports. So that scientific committee is, as we speak, looking into the science of the menthol and making sure that they understand all the science and all the studies that have occurred up to now. And then they're going to be making some recommendations to FDA on that issue, and so you're going to be hearing much more about that very critical issue in the future. Thank you.
Good morning, Jeff Hoffman from Dine International. It's very exciting to hear about the coming together of all the federal agencies to initiate this strategic plan. And I'm wondering if this might be an opportunity to engage the State Department, to invite them to this rollout of the strategic plan, to begin to get them involved.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned the State Department, because I know the top lawyer there, the legal advisor to Secretary Clinton, because he's my brother. So I'm going to be sure to invite Harold to this unveiling on Wednesday. People get us confused all the time, by the way. Yeah. My mother is very proud, by the way, too. But you're right. This is a global issue. Or this is not just a domestic issue. Thank you for your commitment to the global perspective. This is projected to kill some billion people worldwide this century, and a lot of those deaths are going to happen in developing countries. So we need a global approach to this. And also, if I can say, as a Korean American, I have seen dependence just absolutely devastate my extended family. And a couple of years ago, I got to go to Korea and help open a new nicotine research organization there, and they were celebrating that male smoking rates in Korea had dropped below 50%. That's what they were celebrating. So when you go on trips like that and you think about the international impact of all this, this is why I very much appreciate your work. Thank you. Thanks for mentioning that. Thank you. Sold in Italy, France, England, all through Europe. In America, there's a little Well, you raise an excellent point. People don't know what's in these products that are addictive and deadly, and so we need to reverse that. And then your point that other countries have been putting out more aggressive warnings for a decade or more is also an excellent point. You know, in the new FDA authority, they have the authority to put out updated warning labels. So we have lots of possibilities here that you're going to be hearing much more about in the very, very near future. And I think all your points are very, very well taken.
Dr. Coe, good morning. My name is Jim Shoah. I'm with the Canadian Public Health Association. Pleasure to be here. I'm very pleased to hear that you're going to be launching a new federal tobacco control strategy in the United States. I would encourage you, sir, to please share it with your counterparts in Health Canada. Because our federal government is actually going backwards on tobacco control.
Okay.
They have reduced the federal investment in tobacco control. They just took a unilateral decision to abandon 6 years of research on new graphic oral warnings on our cigarette packages. And they are just moving backwards. And we need a little bit of leadership from the U.S. to re-strike the match. Canada might use that term. To light the fire for tobacco control efforts by our federal government, the big John's best analogy. But the other issue I'd like to bring to your attention, sir, is contraband cigarettes. One-third of the cigarettes sold in the province of Quebec are contraband cigarettes from our local Indian reserves. And it's a shared Indian reserve, the Mohawk-Akasasi Reserve. It needs a governance solution, not a law and order solution. And I would urge you, sir, to please again work with our counterparts in Canada on a just solution to that issue.
Thank you so much. This is truly an international effort, as you've pointed out and others have pointed out. And, you know, in some years, the United States is well ahead of the rest of the world, and in many other years, we are behind. So those themes apply to Canada and many other countries as well. I think we have to do this together, learn from one another, encourage each other, and I think your broad themes are very, very helpful to me. So thank you very much. Thank you. That theme is getting more attention. Those regulations have occurred at the local level in some parts of the country, and there's increasing discussion about having that as a unified theme across the country in the future. So we look forward to revisiting that theme with you and creating environments where people can be healthy, and that's a very, very important theme for us.
Actually, I just came from a session where there were two representatives from Congress. Who said they're moving forward on that and we should expect something very soon.
Wonderful.
They've already taken some affirmative steps, but they were talking about substantial restraint.
Thank you.
That was like an hour.
Well, everybody, please join me in thanking.
Thank you all for being here today.